listening to the Sports Daily. I'm your host, Reality Steve. Thank you all for tuning in. Great show for you today. I've got an interview with Fox Sports Radio host Jason Fitz. That's coming up in a little bit. And he's got one hell of a story. I knew about it just by Googling, but listening to him talk and tell the story, really, really cool stuff. I can't wait for you to hear it. And we will get to all that momentarily. This podcast brought to you by BetOnline. BetOnline is the world's most trusted betting platform and your number one source for online betting in 2025. Whether you're a seasoned fan or first-time bettor, BetOnline is your ultimate game day companion with the largest selection of odds on everything from NBA and college basketball to the NHL and UFC. BetOnline continues to be your number one sports betting source. From every three-pointer to hat trick, BetOnline has you covered with odds, stats, and more for every game, every play, and every win. BetOnline, the game starts here. All right, let's get going. Here is Jason Fitz. All right, let's bring him in. He is a football host at Yahoo Sports, also the co-host of The Fellas on Fox Sports Radio. In addition, a Grammy-winning violinist and graduate of the Juilliard School, it is Jason Fitz. Jason, thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. And this is going to be a blast. I'm excited to talk. I think I am the only person ever to get a vote on the Grammys and a vote for the Biletnikoff Award, which is the best wide receiver in college football. So it's definitely been a wild life.
That is crazy. And that's before we jump into sports topics, that's what I wanted to first bring up and introduce you to people who may not have heard you on Fox Sports Radio on Saturday mornings with Anthony Gargano. Your background. I don't know. I know like the basics just off of Google, but this is kind of fascinating to me. How does one go from a professional violinist touring with some of the world's most popular artists, winning Emmys, and getting into the sports talk radio world? How does this happen?
So, you know, there's no easy, quick answer to this. So sorry, it's long-winded. But, you know, for me, I started playing violin when I was four. Taking you all the way back to my childhood, my friend.
Wow.
I started playing the violin when I was four. By the time I was eight, I practiced 8 hours a day. By the time I was 10, I played Carnegie Hall and got into Juilliard. So, like, I was a classical music kid growing up. And in high school, I sang with some buddies, and we were lucky enough to get a record deal, and we thought we were going to be famous, and we never actually put out a record. And, you know, before you know it, we moved to Nashville. And when I moved to Nashville, gosh, it was, you know, the late 90s, and I moved to Nashville to sing with buddies. Like, I was playing the violin on classical stuff. And so when I first started working in Nashville, I was playing in a symphony and playing on huge orchestra recordings. So, like, you know, I played on the Mad Season record for Matchbox 20 is part of the orchestra and things like that. So, like, big orchestra things. And it wasn't until my band was going to hire a fiddle player that I was like, well, that's pretty stupid. So I think I can figure this out. Same instrument, just a different approach. So I started breaking down a bunch of old classic rock records and, you know, looking at electric guitarists and how do they approach solos. And that's sort of made me the fiddle player I was. And so I started playing fiddle, and before you know it, that got me on a bunch of different records. And then I was lucky enough to tour as the fiddle player and band leader for the band Perry for, I guess, 7-8 years. And, you know, when I left the band, we had the fourth biggest song of all time in country music with the Vi Di Young. So yeah. I lived my dream, you know. But our busiest year, man, we were on the road 300 days, our busiest year. And I came home at the end of 300 days and been all over the world. And I remember saying to one of my best friends, like, I'm good at this. I've done it my whole life. I'm thankful to get to do this, but I don't love it. And he just looked at me and he said, if I asked 100 of your friends what you really love, what would the answer be? And I said, sports. He's like, all right, figure out how to talk about sports. And so this was like 2013 before podcasts existed, really. Like, nobody, you couldn't just do that. But I took all my string recording software. I sat in my car because I felt like an idiot. And I recorded a 10-minute show that I put up on Facebook at the time for my friends. And it was amazing. It was the biggest rush I'd had in 10 years. Like, it was incredible to me to see people react and say, this is really good. I love this. Or this is as obnoxious as you are on tour bus talking about sports. So I ripped everything apart and I looked at my life and I said, how do I build something based off what I've accomplished that will let me accomplish something in another industry? And I aggressively started that. So every time we would play shows with anybody that I thought was a football fan or of interest, I would record an interview with them, and I started a podcast where every single week, I would have music guys talk about sports and sports guys talk about music and try and bring those two worlds together. And so I had episodes where, you know, I had Fall Out Boy and Charlie Daniels and Adam Schefter all on the same podcast. And, you know, at the time, again, this was before podcasts are what they were, what they are today. And, you know, I was lucky enough that somebody at ESPN heard it through a bunch of different channels. And man, I'll never forget. He called me and he said, I'm going to give you some notes. And he gave me three pages of tight notes on my podcast. And so the next week I called him and I said, will you listen to this week's? And he called me afterwards and said, I've literally never had anyone take every note I've ever given them until now. And I told him, I was like, that's the Juilliard kid in me. Like, you give me a note. You don't tell me to do it twice. I'll do it the way it needs to be done. And so he said, hey, I think you have a real future in this. And through that process, some of the sports writers I've met had started opening their phone books to me. And I just, man, I just worked on the craft. And in 2016, I got a call from somebody at ESPN and they said, how are you on college football? And I said, I'm great. I can cover college football for sure. And you flash forward about a week later, I got an offer for my first ever TV show on ESPNU, a tiny show, in what they call a usage deal, which means for anyone that doesn't know the business, you can be fired after one show if you're not any good, and you can only do a certain number of shows. And I went to the band, and we were about to put out a new record and a new single. And I said, hey, I need Mondays off in the fall. I'll sub out these shows, no worries. And the band just, they came back at the last minute and decided they weren't comfortable with it. So they said, no, we won't let you do it. So I quit the band with no idea how I was going to pay. I quit the band with the only assurance of that I was going to make $1,000 off of ESPN. That's all I knew. And right after I quit the band, a local station in Nashville where I was living at the time found out that I had quit the band, and they offered me a show on their morning show in sports talk radio that I'll never forget. 4 hours of radio plus 2 hours of meetings a day plus Nashville Predator games at night for $24,000 a year. And I said, man, I need the reps. The money I'll figure out. I need the reps to get better. And so I took that morning show, and ESPN kept giving me more and more shots. And I reached the point where I was sleeping in the studio because I would do 4 hours of national sub radio where I wasn't the host, but I was filling in for somebody. I'd do 4 hours of sub radio. I'd sleep on the couch, and then I'd do my 4 hour morning show, and then I'd go home for the day. So, you know, that's how I lived life for a year, and ESPN recognized it. And before you know it, 2018, I got my first, you know, grown up sort of real contract at ESPN, and been talking about sports ever since.
It's a hell of a story. I mean, that is fascinating stuff. One thing that you said that interested me was when you said after coming off tour for 300 days, you were just like, I didn't love it anymore. What didn't you love? Was it the grind of touring? You had basically just burnt out, or you grew out of, look, I've been playing this instrument my whole life. I just don't want to play it anymore as my job.
That's a good question. So for me, and, you know, so many people when they perform, they get a rush from it, right? Yeah. I never did my whole life. My rush was from playing perfectly. That's the classical music kid in me. So my mom's rule growing up was I didn't have to win a competition. Didn't matter if I lost the competition. When I stood on stage with people to judge what I did, it needed to be the best I'd ever done it. And if it was the best I'd ever done it, this is a Nick Sabanism. He says all the time that you can't worry about being the best, because if you worry about being the best, you're worrying about variables you can't control. You worry about being your best. And I was raised on that principle. So for me, when we played, like we played Hyde Park in London, 110,000 people. I'll never forget. I ran out to the edge of the stage, the end of the stage, had a big catwalk on it, ran all the way down to the catwalk, played a fiddle solo on Fat Bottom Girls by Queen. We covered it. I pulled my in-ears out so I could hear what 110,000 screaming fans sounded like. It was. I remember that so distinctly. But I also remember that after the show, I got in the van and I was like, all right, where are we tomorrow? Like, because to me, the rush was never the crowd. The rush was, can I execute perfectly? And when you're executing 200 and something shows a year, it's just exhausting. So you reach the point where it's like, man, I'm proud of it. But if you don't get the thrill from applause, then touring is just the worst way. Like, it just grinds on you so much over time. And so for me, it was just about the fact that I never got, like, I to this day, I don't need a crowd to clap. Or the weirdest thing on the first radio show I ever did in my life was that I finished the show, and this was before everybody was remote, but I was remote. I finished the show. It was for Sirius XM, and they immediately pressed the disconnect button, and I just sat in the studio in Nashville, and I self-high-fived. I was like, there we go. Good show. Like, so I don't need a crowd to just be like, hey, you're the best. And so that's the part that, without it, I think was just really lacking in my soul.
It's interesting. And this comes from somebody who is absolutely a music novice. I don't really know much about it other than, obviously, I listen to it and I respect the craft. But I had no idea, and this may sound so dumb, I didn't know that basically a fiddle was the same as the violin, or is it not? Like, what is it? Is it the same thing, but just different terms for used for different styles? Like you said, you played fiddle for the band Perry, but I was just like, aren't you playing the violin for the band Perry? Like, why are you saying fiddle for them? Is it just, you need to explain this.
Well, and it's the most common question I've ever gotten in music is, what's the difference between a violin and a fiddle? And I always tell them, who's paying the bill? Like, if you're working for the orchestra, like, it's the same exact instrument. Okay. There's some different style to it and approach to it. But the funny thing is, when I was a kid, you know, before the America's Got Talent era that's really taken over so much of young people today, like, I say that, like, I feel like I sound like I'm 80 when I say that. But when I was a kid, a violinist would never call it a fiddle. Like, classical and country were very separate worlds, like bluegrass, things like that, very separate worlds. Now, for everybody, it's this, like, now it's one instrument. So many kids, so many people that tour right now that you'll see on stage playing the fiddle with a country act have a classical music background. So it's just a matter of, you know, are you reading music? Or are you making it up? Are you playing something off the top of your head? Or are you playing something that Mozart wrote? And then there's some technique things, but it's truly the same instrument. And I think one of the beautiful things about where music has gone is that kids today understand that better than ever. So you get better musicians than ever, because they're not limiting themselves stylistically from the time they're little.
Do you do anything still related to playing? Do you teach private lessons? Do you do anything music? Is it, or sports talk radio is your full-time thing now?
Well, I mean, the only thing I do for money is sports talk radio. Okay. I'll never stop being a musician. You know, like, by the time I left the band, I played primarily, like, I was the fiddle player, but I also played piano and B3 and acoustic and a little bit of viola, a mandolin, a dobro, which is like a slide guitar. So I played a bunch of instruments by the time I left the band. I've got all those on a wall in my living room, and I like to, you know, sit down and write songs at 2 a.m. that only I care about. But also, like, last summer, I sat in with, like, Jordan Davis is a country artist. That's a good buddy of mine. I sat in with Jordan, sat in with Chris Young, another country artist, sat in with Collective Soul. I might sit in with Rascal Flatts in a few weeks. So, like, guys that I knew from touring, I'm certain, like, I still show up and play. Like, I worked my whole life. And one of the questions ESPN asked me, they were like, well, what if you burn out of sports? Will you burn out, you know, of music? And I laugh at that question, because as I told them at the time, my God, like, I've been playing since I was 4. So I don't know. When I got to ESPN, I was about 40. So I'm like, look, if I give you guys 36 years of sports talk, you're going to be tired of me. So, like, you can't take the at this point now, I'm 47. So I got 43 years of playing the violin in my life. I'll never stop playing. I just love that I don't have to worry about playing for money or for business or for commerce, or worrying about if a song is 3.5 minutes and gets to the chorus in the first 40 seconds. Like, I don't have to worry about if it's a hit, you know, all that stuff.
Wow. Yeah, no, it's fascinating. That's a hell of a background story. That's really interesting how you got into this. One thing on your Twitter profile that I wanted to ask you about was, you said you're a Vegas kid by way of Nashville. What is your Vegas ties? How long were you there?
So I was born and raised in Vegas, and we left in middle school because I got into Juilliard. We left and moved to the East Coast. So, like, I guess it was fifth grade, sixth grade that we left. And then we bounced around a lot. And like I said, I got to Nashville. And it's always weird for me when people ask where home is, because, I mean, I got to Nashville in 96 and I lived there until, you know, 2018. So that's a long time in a city. I still have friends and still go back to Nashville all the time. So, you know, Nashville is somewhat home, but Vegas will always, I genuinely believe when you are from Vegas, that is a part of you that sticks with you for life, because everywhere I ever moved, the looks you get when you tell people you're from Vegas, people are always stunned. I think it galvanizes you. So like, even though I didn't spend high school in Vegas, like Vegas is the place that will always identify as home to me.
Interesting. My listening audience knows I'm a huge Vegas guy. Go there at least 3 times a year. I'm going to be there
Let's go.
In a week and a half for, I always go out for first week of March Madness, and I always go out for first week of NFL season. So I've been doing that for, gosh, the NFL one started first week of NFL because I went to college in Southern California, and I remember it specifically. It was the weekend before starting my junior year of college. We're all sitting around, we're playing cards in the dorm, and my buddies are just like, let's go to Vegas. And, you know, 4-hour drive from Southern California. And ever since then, we just decided to make it a guys' trip, first weekend of NFL. And I think we've gone 28 of the 30 years roughly since then. So it's just been a thing. And then I added the first week of March Madness about 2018 because to me, honestly, that first weekend of March Madness is the best sporting event in Vegas. I would never care to go watch the Super Bowl in Vegas. It's one game for 3.5 hours. Sorry. I want to plop myself at a sports book. I'll be at Circa Thursday and Friday for
Oh, Circa is chef's kiss, man. That is the way to I was gonna ask if you're going to Circa. That's amazing. Good for you.
Yeah, at 10, I want 10 straight hours of 16 games on Thursday, 16 games on Friday, and just never move my ass. I mean, it's just so much better. I mean, I love first weekend of NFL, but again, that's just one day. It's, you know, that Saturday is week two of college, which has kind of become a little bit irrelevant because they start putting all the big ones on week one and week zero now. So it's just like, you know, I'm fine with, you know, 8 or 10 morning games in the NFL and 3 or 4 in the afternoon, but it's one day. You just can't beat. I don't think there's a better event, at least for me, to go to Vegas for than first weekend of March Madness. And so, yeah, going out in
you're,
about 10
you're, you're, by the way, 1,000% right. I thought about going out this year. I'm going to go to a sports book up in New England where I currently am because it's the best way to watch it. So funny sports book basketball story that actually helped change my life. The ACM Awards, the Academy of Country Music Awards, are in Vegas every year, or they were when I played them. And they used to be on the same weekend as the Final Four. And so what was funny is the year that we played the Band Perry played the Houston Rodeo, I just started the pod and I was listening to a guy named John McClain all the time. That's a
Oh yeah.
huge sports writer in Houston.
Houston,
Houston,
yeah.
John changed my life. And I reached out because I listened to him on radio all the time. I just cold emailed him and said, I don't know you, but I listen to you all the time on the radio. I'm going to leave you tickets to Houston Rodeo in case you're a big country music fan, because we're in Houston, and I just want to say thanks for entertaining me on the radio. And so the funny thing is, John emailed me back and was like, I don't like country music at all, but that's cool, and I'd love to meet you. So over time, we became friends, and he always takes his wife out to the Final Four in Vegas every year with another family. And so for years, we were out there in the ACM Awards the same weekend, so I'd always see John. And this is a life lesson I always tell kids that are trying to make it in life. I sat down with John at dinner one night, and he said, "Man, you've kind of hurt my feelings as a friend." And I take that seriously, so I asked him why. And we were in Vegas at Caesar's Palace at the time. And John said, "Well, you tweet about this podcast that you've got, and I'm in sports, and you've never asked me to come on the podcast." And I said, "Well, John, I don't want you to think that our friendship was based on me wanting anything from you. Like, I don't do life that way. I don't ask people for things. I just try and make real relationships." And so he was like, "Well, I'd like to come on your podcast." So the next week, I set up a time with him, and I had the interview ready, and I sat in a locker room somewhere and interviewed John. And he was the one that called me afterwards and said, "Hey, you're really good at this, and I'm going to make my phone book your phone book. So I'm going to introduce you to Adam Schefter, Peter King, a bevy of other guys that just absolutely changed my life." So it's funny because being in Vegas with John at the Final Four in the ACMs was really a weekend that helped change my life without John McClain's help in that moment. And I tell kids all that time because, like, a basic life principle for me is let's be old guys for a minute. If you went back and you said to somebody, "I'm a musician, here's my CD," that person immediately is going to think your CD sucks. Like, I'm just telling you now, everybody thinks your music sucks. If you spend, this is the Nashville method. If you spend a year getting coffee with somebody, you get to know them. And every time you talk to them, it's like, what's going on? Man, the music stuff's going pretty well, playing on some stuff, really happy with what I'm writing right now. That's it. And then you go on to life and you make real connections with people. Eventually, that same person is going to be like, man, I hear about your music all the time. I'd love to hear some of it. And when they receive it, they receive it with benefit of the doubt because they like you.
Yeah.
And like, I think where so many people go wrong, like, because I get asked a lot, like, how do you get two dream jobs? I got two dream jobs by always taking the time to be able to build real relationships so that whenever somebody does consume what you've done, they consume it differently. I believe that at my core. And when somebody likes you, they think you're good at what you do. And when somebody doesn't know you, 99% of the time, they think you suck. So you got to take the time to break through that.
Interesting. Yeah, it's a great life lesson, really. This is a good segue into, I want to talk Vegas sports right off the bat. And it's obviously taken off in the last few years. Vegas loves their hockey. I mean, the Golden Knights, I've even been to the Golden Knights game. I was actually at Game 5 when the Capitals won at T-Mobile. Happened to be there that weekend, so I was like, I'm going to get tickets. I want to go to the game. I love the arena. Obviously, football is working. I think when the team actually gets good, I think Vegas will absolutely support that team. We all know that the Vegas City is going to get a basketball franchise, an NBA franchise. They'll be next on the list. But then there's baseball, and I'm curious about this. Someone who grew up in Vegas, I don't know. I mean, we know they're getting it, I think, eventually. We keep hearing all these things going and, public funding and private funding for this stadium, and they're going to build it where, you know, they've already imploded the Trop, and they're going to build it on that corner there. Or then you hear, oh, no, that's going to be over by. They're going to bulldoze the Rio. It's going to be out there. Whatever. Looks like they're getting baseball in 27 or 28. How do you think baseball is going to go over in Vegas? Only because football is easy. You play 8 home games a year. It's very easy, and you've got the other team's fans coming into town. They'd be like, oh, let's make it the one road game we go this year. Let's go to Vegas. Basketball, hockey speak for themselves. Baseball is a little bit different. When this whatever Vegas team, whatever they're going to call themselves, if they call themselves the A's, even if the Washington Nationals come in for a 3-game set Monday through Wednesday, sure, they're probably going to be passing out free tickets on the strip somewhere. I don't know if this is going to work in Vegas for baseball, because I think it's very successful. Like I said, in football, the visiting teams come in, they make a weekend out of it. Baseball, there's always going to be a 3 or 4 game set. I mean, yeah, they got 2 game series now, but you know what I'm saying? Like, it just seems, yeah. I don't know if this is going to work, but as a Vegas guy, you know more about the city than I do. Do you think this can work for them?
Baseball has to take a totally different approach, and I'm not sure they're going to want to. Like, to your point, I don't believe that there's a lot of Washington fans that are going to come in midweek.
Yeah.
You know, I think your weekend games are going to be fine, but your midweek games are going to really struggle. So now you got to ask yourself, are you building for locals or are you building for travelers? And where the Golden Knights got so I don't want to say lucky, because that's a weird term to use here, but the Golden Knights inaugural season hit Vegas right as the mass shooting happened.
Yeah.
And it became a heartbreaking, galvanizing moment for that club, for the city. It really brought, like, the Golden Knights were bringing joy to the city and a distraction to the city when they needed it more than ever. And they were the first pro team there. I don't think you can ever put those elements together. You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube to recreate that. So now you got to ask, okay, well, what are other teams there? And the Raiders, you're right, they are at this point they're a money-making machine. Everybody that has tickets is happy because they're selling those tickets and making money off those tickets. Once they win some games, I think it can be successful. I'm not sure strip baseball makes any sense. Like, minor league baseball has done really well in Vegas,
yeah,
but that's for the locals. So to me, if they really want to build a local like following, which is what I think you need for baseball, the stadium shouldn't be on the strip. That stadium needs to be somewhere where locals will want to access it night in and night out, because that's your only real shot, I think, with baseball. And by the way, I think the A's ownership group is just absolutely so incompetent. If I had to place a wager on it right now, I think there's a better chance that Vegas ends up with an expansion team than the A's. I think all of this A stuff is going to turn out to be a big old smokescreen unless the Fishers sell. So I'm not confident the A's end up in Vegas. I am confident Vegas gets baseball. But when it happens, I genuinely think it would be more successful if it was off the strip, even though, like, as a Vegas goer, I go back two or three times a year. I would always go to a game if I was there. So I get that. Like, I get that there are people like me. I don't think you can bank your whole business on that for baseball particularly.
Yeah, it seems it would be tough. Every rendering I've seen of a potential stadium, whether it is there on the corner where the Trop used to be, it seems to be open air. And yes, I know that the minor league team has been successful and they don't have a dome, but can you have an outdoor stadium on the strip? Well, even if they don't do it on the strip, can you have an outdoor stadium in Vegas? I mean, who wants to sit in 105 from June to September to watch baseball? I would think that any rendering has got to be some retractable roof or something like SoFi where it's like open air, but it is kind of closed. But that's the other thing. I'm just surprised that every rendering I see for a potential stadium doesn't seem to be a dome stadium. And I just don't know how that works. It works for minor league. I get it. But I don't know about pro. You've been out there.
I'm with you.
I'm there in the summer. I'm just, it's ridiculous.
The amount of extra walking we all do in Vegas in the summer just to make sure we stay indoors.
Yeah.
I mean, because you can get through the connected paths. This is a – nobody's building this and nobody's even talking about it. But if I were the czar of the world, frankly, I would turn around and I would create a casino that has a basketball arena attached to it on one side and an indoor Major League Baseball arena attached to it on the other side. And I would make a sports resort. Like, because I think where you can always win is if it's indoors and it's attached to something, then it's like, yeah, we'll walk in through that and like, hey, let's just go to a baseball game. Like, that makes a lot of sense to me. Putting that thing outdoors makes absolutely no sense to me at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'll be there in June as well, and that is, you know, that's just sitting there at 105 and no clouds, and I'm just like, who's going to want to sit and watch a baseball game in this? So, yeah, you wonder if they decide to do something different, if the renderings become different, but yeah, everything I've seen up to this point. And like you said, we're 3 or 4 years away. This earliest looks like 2027, 2028, but yeah, the A's are going to play. Oh, they're going to be in Sacramento for 3 years, and then we'll see exactly what happens. But you think it's going to be an expansion team and not the A's? Is what you're thinking at?
Yeah, I think so. But you know, unless the A's are sold, I don't think the Fishers are going to be able to put it together. And look, the other side of this for everybody that sits here and yells about the Raiders portion of this, like, let me loudly say this, because I know this. I do some work for the Raiders on the side. I grew up a lifelong diehard Raiders fan, so I do some free work for them for gear, because I grew up an L.A. Raiders fan that became an Oakland Raiders fan that now they're in my city, right? So, like, I'm even more galvanized. But I was on the season ticket waiting list, and when they got to me, they only had great seats left, and the PSLs for them were, like, $30,000 a ticket, I think. And so I said, no, I was like, I'm living in Connecticut. I'm not going to spend $60,000 on season tickets to the Raiders. And the girl that was on the phone from the sales organization even said, she's like, you'll make that money back if you sell your tickets for the first 5 years. And I laughed. And then I have a buddy that did buy the tickets. He got 10 grand each for the first game. Like, he's already made so much money off of these. So, like, when people complain about how many people are in the stadium, I just want to remember and how many Raiders fans are in the stadium. I want to remind everybody that there's a waiting list. Like, Allegiant Stadium is sold out. So the Raiders, the city, everybody else involved in this, they don't really care. Like, they're making a ton of money off this thing. The people that bought the tickets are making a ton of money. Like, sports in Vegas makes money. Now, when the team gets really good, I think the city will flock to support them. But until then, I'm not going to fault everybody for being entrepreneurial instead of watching a terrible 4-win football team.
So I want to keep it in the NFL. This Matthew Stafford thing kind of fascinated me last week, because the flirtation with the Raiders and Tom Brady, and oh my gosh, they're skiing in the same resort in Wyoming, and you know, the fight between the journalists that are apparently that it went down, and who reported what and when, and all this stuff. And you know, I'm sitting there going, wait a second. If I'm Matthew Stafford, and the teams that basically were being thrown out were the Giants or the Raiders, or going back to the Rams, and I'm sitting there going, the Giants, a three-win team, 3,000 miles across the country, when he was literally 13 yards away from beating the eventual world champions. They gave the Philadelphia Eagles their toughest playoff game because the Eagles rolled Washington and rolled Kansas City, but the Rams had first and 10 on the 13-yard line, down 6 points at the end of that game. I mean, they were that close. I'm like, first off, why would Matthew Stafford want to go to the Giants? Then someone told me, hey, his wife's brother is the assistant quarterback's coach for the Giants. I'm like, okay, but is that really a reason to want to go to a three-win team when you've got this team? You're in Southern California. You've won a Super Bowl with this team. And then the fascination with the Raiders. And I'm like, okay, $100 million in salary cap space. I get it. Tom Brady, new coaching staff, Pete Carroll. I get it to where you would build, but Pete Carroll, I mean, Matthew Stafford's 37. Why does he want to go to a team that won 4 games last year? And the biggest thing for me was, why would you want to go to the AFC? Because if I asked you right now, who's the best quarterback in the NFC? Before 2 months ago, the answer wasn't Jalen Hurts. But yeah, I guess you got to say Jalen Hurts now because he has a Super Bowl. He's the only guy in the NFC right now that's quarterbacking a team that has a Super Bowl ring outside of Stafford. So Stafford's in your top three. You go to the AFC, why would you want to deal with Mahomes, Allen, Jackson, Burrow? Pretty much every year, it's a gauntlet in the playoffs. It never made any sense to me. And then he finally resigns, and I'm like, yeah, this is probably, it was probably a lot of window dressing. And I'm sure the Raiders wanted him, but it never even made sense to me why this guy would even consider leaving the Rams, unless there was something I was missing.
Yeah, no, and I'll add on to that. So let's say he goes to the Giants and he has the best season of his life.
Yeah.
If we're being honest, that probably makes him the third best quarterback on the third best team in his own division.
Yeah, exactly.
If he goes to the Raiders and he does the same thing, best season of his career, he might be in fourth place in that division. So, like, why at this point would he want to go somewhere where he's going to get the snot beat out of him and he's really going to be on the outside looking in of most playoff opportunities, or he can stay where he is? This is a player that really felt like his worth was at X, and the Rams felt like his worth was at Y. And so they said, go out and test it. And unlike Saquon with the Giants and the Eagles, the difference here is that he tested it, came back, and then the Rams said, okay, we're not going to totally meet that worth, but we'll give you a lot more than we thought we were going to give you. And that's all this was just getting a big old fat raise for him. And I understand, like, look, the quarterbacks in this year's draft, I don't think either one are as it's never a sure thing, but you can't be as confident in this year's quarterback class as you have in last year's or the one before. I've covered the draft for 8 years. I think this is pretty similar to the Kenny Pickett sort of no real starter in the first round draft. I don't think there's a franchise savior. So I would understand why the Raiders and the Giants and the Jets, for example, would be aggressive. If I'm Matt Stafford, I'll use that aggressiveness to go get myself more money. And then I'll sit in my bed like Scrooge McDuck, just laying around in my dollar bills. But I'm not leaving. There's not a chance I was leaving for that.
Yeah, no, it just never made any sense. It was probably a negotiating ploy. And I know the Raiders, I mean, the numbers being thrown around where they were offering $50 million a year, but Matt Stafford has never struck me as a guy that is out chasing money. I do think this guy cares about his legacy. I think he cares about winning. If he didn't care about winning and he just wanted to end his career with the biggest contract, then yeah, it would have made sense. Just go to the Raiders, get $50 million a year, get your head kicked in for probably 2 or 3 years, because he's 37. He's probably got 3 years max left in this league. But he never struck me as a guy that was chasing money. And this makes all the sense in the world. Him and Hurts, like I said, only two quarterbacks in the NFC that even have a Super Bowl title. And he's right there. I mean, I know that Lamar and I know that Josh Allen and Joe Burrow don't have Super Bowl rings themselves either. But I think that having to face them in the playoffs every single year, because we pretty much think those teams are going to be playoff teams every year, why would you put yourself through that? You're not going to win. If you want to win, you stay with the Rams. And that's And that's what he ended up doing, and good for him. And it makes all the sense in the world because the Rams just great front office. They seem to draft well. They ended up getting the defensive rookie of the year and Jared Verse. I mean, they're a solid team. They got a good running back. They just seem to plug and play. And they're going to be an NFC favorite next year. I mean, they're really good. Like we said, they gave the Eagles their biggest test of the postseason. It wasn't even close. The Eagles rolled everybody else. I really thought he was staying, and he ended up staying. I do want to talk college football a little bit as well with you because, like you said, you cover the draft, and you kind of already answered the question because I was going to ask you about Cam Ward and Shedeur Sanders. If you're Tennessee at one, you've got Will Levis, but Will Levis in 2 years has not shown he is a franchise quarterback. Granted, maybe the switch flips in year three. I don't tend to think it will with him, but you never know. But if you're Tennessee at one, what do? Do you take Cam Ward? Do you take a more sure thing and a Travis Hunter? Do you take the linebacker from Penn State? What do at one if you're Tennessee?
So here's the thing for me. I don't think a quarterback fixes everything for Tennessee the way, you know, Jaden Daniels had so much success last year. But as we got ready for last year's draft, I talked to some people in the league, and I heard that the Washington Commanders were offered as much as 3 first-rounders and 2 second-rounders because people wanted Jaden Daniels that bad. So, like, I think sometimes right now what people say is, well, look at what Jaden did. And then they act like we didn't all see that coming from a mile away. We certainly did, right? So in this situation, you got to look at it from everybody's standpoint and ask yourself, is this the guy? And you know, you cover so much reality TV, right? Like Bachelor shows in general. Think about this. This is a dating analogy I use a lot with this. We all know somebody in life that gets engaged and he comes in and he's like, hey, we got engaged. And the whole room's like, oh, really? Why? Well, it was time. We've been together. And, you know, year 4 is just kind of when you do that. Like, does that marriage ever work out? The answer is no. That marriage never works out, right? That's never a long, happy, beautiful marriage. Just because you need a quarterback and you're like, I don't know, guys, it's time. We stink. We don't have one. You don't waste the first overall pick in the draft. Like Abdul Carter, the defensive lineman out of Penn State, looks like he could be a wild difference maker. And we're talking about an NFL right now where every single edge rusher is getting paid a ton of money. It's a hugely important position, right? So I can justify Abdul Carter. I can justify Travis Hunter, the wide receiver slash corner that everybody loves out of Colorado. I've had people tell me, literally, that they believe he can be Darrell Revis on one side of the ball, and people tell me they believe he can be Justin Jefferson on the other. So, like, you're talking about somebody that could literally be a great player. I think it makes the most sense to make him a DB and then give him 20 plays on offense. But this is a level of dynamic that, I don't know, I think when your team stinks, best player available never fails you. So even though you're desperate for a quarterback and the whole organization wants a quarterback and the fans want a quarterback, like, I'm sorry, if you're the Titans, the Browns, the Giants, the Raiders, the Jets, you need a quarterback and there aren't any good options. You're up a creek. There's no good answer this year. And people keep looking at the puzzle like they're going to find the answer. And it's like, it isn't there, y'all. Like, I think you're way better just going best player available. And then if you have to give up a bounty next year, give up a bounty next year to move up and try and get a quarterback. Like, take your shot then. I don't think there's a single shot worth taking this year in the top 10 of the draft.
I think Cleveland's at 2. They're probably going to go for a quarterback. And like you said, they're going to be stuck with – not stuck, but like you said, you hear all these names. Tyler Shuck is making some noise after the combine. Everyone's now excited about Jackson Dart. I mean, look, we don't know. It's just such a crapshoot when it comes to quarterbacks. Everybody thought Caleb Williams, you know, not everybody, but a lot of people thought Caleb Williams, oh, just can't miss first round, you know, got to be 1-1, no doubt. And, you know, he struggled. And Jaden Daniels ended up being obviously way better. Maybe Caleb Williams gets better next year, better offensive coach. I definitely think having Matt Eberflus as his coach probably didn't help matters. He's got an offensive mind now that is the hottest offensive mind in the NFL the last 2 years in Ben Johnson. They've already picked up 2 offensive linemen in free agency. So they are clearly saying, like, hey, we're putting everything around you, Caleb. If he doesn't perform in the next, you know, this year and next year, Maybe it's ends up being like, okay, maybe we just made the wrong pick here. But, you know, when I look at it, man, NFL is such a crapshoot when it comes to quarterbacks, and we got to give it time. We still don't know about Drake May. He's obviously going to be the starter next year. We don't know yet about some other. I mean, Bo Nix did great in his first year, but he was a guy that coming out of the draft, I was very, very worried about just because I watched a lot of Oregon games in college and Auburn, and I'm like, this guy throws nothing but bubble screens. I don't see him pushing the ball down the field, but yet he played great in his first season. So maybe I'm wrong. I'm the idiot here. But yeah,
here's what I'd say about Bo Nix. I don't think Bo Nix is Bo Nix if he doesn't get drafted by Sean Payton, who knew exactly what he wanted to get out of Bo Nix. Systems matter. And then the other thing I'd say when it comes to quarterback, every single team we've talked about right now, if they take a chance on a quarterback in the second round, I love it. Because there are some inevitabilities. I got it years ago when I was with ESPN. I did an interview with Max Crosby. And what we did is we sat in a tattoo parlor in Vegas. We got tattoos while we did the interview. And it was like 4 hours in the chair. It's one of the coolest interviews I've ever been a part of. But I remember midway through that interview asking Max, who just signed a massive new contract with the Raiders. I asked him about how often he thought about where he was drafted. And he said, you know what? They never forget the number that was by your name when you were brought into the league. And that's real for guys that were drafted too low. It's real for guys that were drafted higher than maybe they should have been. So, it's not Cam Ward or Shedeur Sanders' fault if they get drafted super high. Teams are overdrafting at the position. But what's wild to me is that Jalen Hurts was a second-round pick, right? And I think because he was a second-round pick, it sort of changes the way you view everything he does for the first couple of years of the season, because everybody has an understanding. Well, he was a second rounder, might take him a minute. We don't want to have that same understanding. If Jackson Dart goes at the top of the second round, it's going to be a home run. It's a steal. And everybody's going to say, look at this, because he's going to get time to develop and we'll see what he can be. If Jackson Dart is taken seventh overall by the Jets, then all of a sudden that timeline changes, the way we view the player changes, the expectation of his greatness changes. No fault of the player. It's just when you do this from a drafting standpoint, you change the metrics. So I think that's the hardest part of this, is that Cam, Shedeur, Jackson, Jalen Milroe, Quinn Ewers, these are all quarterbacks that I think, if they were drafted in the right system, a la Bo Nix, they were given a year or two to learn that system, kind of like Jordan Love. I think any of them could turn out to be pretty darn good quarterbacks. Are we going to do that with the first overall pick? No. First overall pick, if he goes to Tennessee, is going to be thrown straight to the Wolves with a coach that's coaching for his job because the first year went really poorly in an organization that I've covered is about as dysfunctional as you can get on timelines. So Cam Ward's entire career changes through no fault of his own because he was the first overall pick.
Yeah, for sure. You know, when I reached out to you a couple weeks ago, it was because after I had heard you on the fellas in a heated discussion with your co-host at the time, and it literally woke me up because it was about 4 a.m. my time, and I'm like, I can't believe what I'm hearing here. This thing just kind of carried on. But the point that was being discussed, and it's something I've brought up quite a bit on my podcast recently, is the whole idea of the NBA. And you can kind of relate it to a lot of sports outside of the NFL, because the NFL regular season means so much. With an 82-game NBA season, an 82-game hockey season, 162-game regular season in baseball, it's just not the same as it was when you and I both grew up. We're roughly the same age, and sports are just different. And you have to adapt and change with the times. And the point that you were making on that show that day is something I agree with, that I can't get behind. I mean, I grew up in Southern California. I was all about Showtime Lakers. I'd stay up late at night listening to Chick Hearn call those Laker games. Love the Lakers. Watched them all the time. CBS and Dick Stockton and Pat Vermeil on the CBS when Lakers in Boston in the finals. This is what I grew up on, and I can readily admit, I think the players in the NBA today are way better than they were in the 80s, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the product in the regular season is all that intriguing to watch. And I know that your co-host got very upset at guys' load management, guys don't want to play, and they sit out. But I'm agreeing with you here. Hey, this is just kind of the way it is. It doesn't mean that these guys aren't good or they don't care, but it's just so hard. I know your boy is an old school guy, you know, an old school Philly guy. He grew up talking about the Sixers, watching the Sixers and Dr. J and all this, but I'm fine with guys on load management. I'm fine with guys sitting out a Tuesday game in February just because we as the media right now in sports, it is all about what have you done for me lately in the playoffs. I don't care what you do in the regular season. It does not matter. The two teams I openly root for are the Dodgers and the Lakers. Up until last season, it was me banging my head against the wall when the Dodgers won 100 to 105 games every regular season, win the NL West every year, and then get swept by a team they finished 18 games better than because it came down to a five-game series in the playoffs. Finally, they, you know, broke that streak last year, but this is what I mean. It's just, this is the way sports is, and I really love the point that you made. I kind of want you to make it again. Like, it's okay that our guys are taking some time out, and they are getting themselves ready for the postseason because that's all that matters, and that's what we all talk about.
And what's funny to me is I've been lucky enough in my career to do First Take a few times. But think about what the First Take method is, right? Yeah. Right. You know, the First Take method is to sit down and say, no matter what, it's not good enough. No matter what, LeBron's not better than MJ, which, by the way, who's better, LeBron or Michael Jordan, truly, to me, is the grown-up equivalent of my dad can beat up your dad. Like, yeah. We can't prove it. They're never going to fight. We don't really know. It's all personal opinion. Yeah. But all this stuff gets blown up. And then what happens with the NBA particularly is it's only about chips. That's all anybody wants to talk about is, well, how many championships did you win? And how did you play in championship moments? And, like, I think it's such a failed way to cover everything. And this is where people tell me it's a loser's mentality. And like, I don't think I told the story on the air, but I remember this very distinctly when the band Perry had a song called Don't Let Me Be Lonely. And I remember we were in Canada when Don't Let Me Be Lonely peaked on the charts, and it peaked at number two. We fired everybody. We fired publicists. We fired people at the label. We fired everybody, because that song is supposed to go number one and it went number two. I look back at my own life and I'm like, that was so stupid. We sat raging on a bus because we had the number two song in country music and not the number one song. Like, that's a failed way to cover everything. And that's exactly what we do every single time with basketball, particularly more than any other sport. I think we do it with basketball. So now tell me this, like, is anyone going to remember if Giannis misses 10 games during the regular season?
No.
Not if he plays well in the playoffs. I mean, if Giannis wins a championship, nobody's going to talk about a random Tuesday in February. And I think what we have to do instead of complaining about load management is understand that we, the audience, have set the expectation. And if we set the expectation that the only thing that matters is championships, then why are we turning around trashing people for doing what helps them win championships? As I said repeatedly, the person that figured out load management is Popovich, one of the most just heralded, loved, renowned coaches in all of sports history, figured out load management. We don't sit here and say that should tarnish his legacy. He just looked around and said, man, I want my guys fresh in June. I don't care about February. That's actually kind of brilliant. So, like, the old basketball head is the one that figured out load management, and they didn't figure it out because the guy just wants to take a Tuesday off. They figured it out because it's part of a longer system to try and get guys to play longer, to have guys fresher in the playoffs, and try and win the championships. And you know, as a Dodgers fan, you said it. Like, if the Dodgers rest everybody in the middle of the regular season and they lose 2 weeks worth of games and you went to them and you blew your money, it doesn't matter if they win the World Series. But the opposite, man, if they lose the World Series because they don't have any legs left in them, you'll remember that forever. Like, that's the way we cover it.
Yeah, and, you know, I think the argument that you hear on the other side a lot is, I work my ass off to take my kid to one game a year, and so superstar decided to sit out. He doesn't want to play, even though he's making $40 or $50 million. It's like, okay, does that happen? Yes, but I think your kid's gonna be fine. Like, I get it. I understand what they're saying, but it's such small potatoes compared to the bigger picture. These teams are taking care of their franchise, and unfortunately, they don't care about your child who went to one game a year that you saved up for. It just doesn't. Maybe that's a harsh reality, but they're thinking bigger picture. And I'm guessing if you saved up a bunch of money, bought one game a year, and you wanted to see Steph Curry play, and he happens to sit out that game, but Steph Curry ends up winning the title that year. I think your kid will remember that more than going to a game that Steph happened to be on the bench on, you know?
I have to loudly point, because I hear this logic all the time. Well, kids, all right, how many people do we think are genuinely taking their kid to that random, let's say, Golden State game? Even if there's 100 people in the crowd that are impacted by it, a quick Google search shows me last year, game 5 of the NBA Finals was watched by 6.3 million people.
Yeah.
If 100 people have a terrible experience night in and night out, but it allows 6.3 million people to watch the NBA Finals, like, who wins there? You know, that's just the reality of the entire beast of it all, you know, and it certainly doesn't feel good to say this. Like, I understand why we all want to see players go out and give their everything. I believe you have a responsibility to do your best to, you know, to value the money that people pay. Like, every job I've ever had has been fan supported in my life. If it weren't for fans listening and buying, I wouldn't have jobs. So for me, I'll power through anything because that's how I'm wired. But my God, like, if you're sitting here and you're, you know, insert player name here, my God, they get questioned every time they have an injury. Is it real? You know, like, it's just players are in a lose-lose situation through this. Nobody wants to feel sorry for the players because they're millionaires playing a game, but I don't know, we're watching it. So, and the other point that I've made repeatedly is that youth basketball numbers are skyrocketing. So we're looking like, I looked it up the other day, and percentages, it's up like 20-30% over the last few years. Participation in youth basketball, particularly at the elementary school level. So I guess I would ask everybody, if you think the future of basketball is in peril, the NBA is in peril, fifth grader, why is he picking up the ball? He's not picking it up just because his dad loves playing basketball with him or his mom loves playing basketball with him or her. He's picking up the ball because he's watched basketball at some point in a way that has him excited to play basketball. Like, that's the thing I keep screaming is that clippable downloads and, you know, key plays from the game. That's how people consume basketball now. So as long as Anthony Edwards is postering somebody, the kids aren't going to care about a Tuesday night.
Yeah. And you know, the discussion you had with your co-host that day with Anthony, it was the exact same thing. He's got kids. I've got a nephew that is about to be 18 years old. He has never, ever, as far as I know, I don't live with him, but I see him enough, talk to him enough to where I don't think he's ever sat down, except when I've taken him to games because I am a Dallas Mavericks season ticket holder. Well, I canceled the second
I traded
Luka.
Good for you.
I decided to just be like, no, I don't, because I went to games, one, for social aspect of it, and two, because Luka was capable of putting on a Luka game anytime I went. That's why I went to the Mavericks. They don't have that anymore. I don't need to go. But my nephew, outside of the games that I've taken to, I know for a fact has never watched an NBA game from beginning to end. But if I asked him, can you name me the first 14 picks in the NBA draft last year, he can name me the player, where they went to college, and who they went to. Just because he consumes all of his media and all of his sports media on highlights and YouTube. So that's where they're getting their fan base from. His kid's never watched a game from beginning to end in his life, but he knows so much about the NBA. It kind of boggles my mind because you and I didn't grow up on that. We had to watch CBS. We had to watch the NBA Finals, even though they were on tape delay in the late 70s. I mean, we had to watch the games to know what the hell was going on. We had no internet growing up in the 80s. You know, it's totally different now. And yes, Larry Bird and Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan, when they were in their heyday, did they play 82 games a year? Yes, they did. They traveled coach. They didn't have the health and nutrition that all these players have, and they also got paid way less. I get it, but it seems like that's just such a boomer argument to be making now that, oh, you know, these guys, when I watched NBA back in my day, these guys never took time off. Yeah, but it was a different game. You can't compare 80s basketball to 2025 basketball. You just can't. It's not the same.
I also, like, my first real deal with ESPN was largely based on radio 5 days a week and then also digital hosting. And so I was one of the original hosts that helped launch SportsCenter on Snapchat. And I say that because I remember the night I was on radio with Sarah Spain on Spain and Fitz at the time. And it was the night that Alex Smith got traded from the Chiefs to Washington. And we blew up the radio show because football is king on radio. So we blew up the radio show and we did our entire 3-hour show on this mega trade. And I'll never forget this. I walked one building over on the ESPN campus in Bristol, Connecticut. I sat down with the production staff for SportsCenter on Snapchat because that taped in the wee hours of the morning. And as I walked into the production meeting, I said, man, I've got pages of notes on Alex Smith. I'm so ready for this Alex Smith talk. And the producer of that episode said, no, our audience does not care about Alex Smith. And I laughed. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. And he said, nope, we're leading with the Lonzo Ball highlight tonight. I was like, that's stupid. So I did my job because that's what I've always done. And I delivered, you know, SportsCenter on Snapchat. And by the way, as I told Anthony, this is why, even though I don't have kids, I say, like, I know more about how kids consume media because I worked in kids media, right? Like, so 3.5 million kids a day watch SportsCenter on Snapchat when we launched it. 3.5 million kids between the ages of 13 and 24 every day. We, like, the numbers on that thing crushed. So the next day, we could see dailies when people click through. I came in and I went to the producers and I was like, I want to see the clicks from last night. I want to see what happened. And by God, the minute we got to Alex Smith getting traded as a story, we lost everybody. We lost the entire audience that night, but we didn't lose the audience through all the NBA highlights. And that's why I continually yell to Anthony and everybody else. Like, if you are saying the NBA is dying or dead, what you're not doing is acknowledging how the NBA now is consumed. And that's why the biggest part of the ESPN contract that they signed at the time, this is before the brand new one, the contract they signed at the time was for over $1 billion, and everybody freaked out. Like, how could you give $1 billion a year to the NBA? And what nobody understood is it's because that those deals included digital rights. So it allowed us to show highlights on Snapchat and highlights on YouTube and highlights on all of the digital shows, the live streams that were, you know, my NFL draft live stream that I did with Mina Kimes and Mike Golub Jr. We had 10 million viewers for that, right? Like, so that's the audience that is being fed now. And so when people say the NBA is dying, my argument to that is the NBA is doing actually everything it needs to do to not become Major League Baseball. Because, like, baseball is a niche sport that an older audience watches. We study those metrics in radio and TV. But basketball has a young audience that is flocking. Like, a basketball highlight will do better to this day on SportsCenter on Snapchat than anything they put on the NFL. And that's fact.
Yeah, and I don't doubt it. And it's funny because when I was growing up in the 80s, you were growing up in the 80s, baseball was king. And it's just the sport has never changed. It's never adapted, yet it's the same sport as it was in the 80s outside of, you know, a couple rule changes now to speed up the game. But it's like funny to think back. It's just because I guess the times that we were in, people just like to, hey, let's turn on the ball game and lay back on the recliner and sit here for 3 hours. But we can all admit baseball is boring to watch on television. It just is. There's not enough action, especially since the NFL – way more action, NBA, way more action. But in the 80s, they were all three sports were around back then, and baseball was king. And now it is absolutely a niche sport until playoff time. I can get into playoff baseball, but again, like we talk about February NBA games that are just irrelevant, so is, you know, a June 30th game between the Reds and the Nationals. It doesn't matter. Just get me to the fucking playoffs. Just get me there, and I am in on a baseball playoff game.
And by the way, like, I cover college basketball for Yahoo also. That's like it's one of my side things that I do because I love the sport.
Yeah.
Nobody cares about the fact that November college basketball doesn't matter.
Yeah.
We all care about the tournament, but, like, ain't nobody watching UConn in November outside of Connecticut, right? Like, I grew up going to those UNLV games, the Larry Johnson, Stacey Augmon years. Like, I awesome. Grew up going to those. And, like, that was life then. But, like, nobody cares about it now. What we have to remember when we talk about broadcasting when we were kids and even into the 90s and 2000s is, like, the NBA didn't used to have a league pass streaming option where you could watch every game. Like, you know, the generation that's complaining about taking games off, well, Hell, they wouldn't have known if a player took a game off. Like, there wasn't 24-hour coverage of it this way. And when the NBA was on, like, NBC, it was a big deal, right? That was going to be Lakers, Celtics, everybody tuned in, because you didn't get to see the Lakers and the Celtics very often unless you lived in that market, right? So now we have to just accept the fact that if you are a Memphis Grizzlies fan, you can watch every Memphis game. As a guy that loves hockey, like, I'm still able to watch the Golden Knights and the Nashville Predators wherever I am, because streaming has created that. So, like, this concept of, well, it used to matter and we all used to flock to, yeah, we didn't have options. Like, you probably love meatloaf if you've never had filet.
Yeah. I mean, it is fascinating how the times have changed, how the sport is covered. I mean, I've talked about this numerous times, but people don't understand, especially the 20-year-olds right now. You don't understand, especially NFL Sunday, when it was only played on Sunday. There was no Thursday night games. There were Sunday games, and there was Monday night football. And it wasn't until halftime of Monday night football that you actually saw highlights from the games on Sunday. Like, that's how long you had to wait. Now you get, if Tyreek Hill catches a 50-yard streak down the sideline, you know about it on Twitter 10 seconds after it happens. But in the 80s,
dude, I used to sit there and just watch NBC, because that was the AFC channel, yeah, and the 10-minute ticker every 10 minutes would come up and tell you the score. Yeah. The only way I knew the score of the Raiders game when I wasn't living in a Raiders market was for the 10-minute ticker. And then you're right. Like, I used to get to stay up late on Sunday night so I could watch NFL primetime, yeah, and so I could watch the George Michael sports machine. Those were the only two ways I could see any Raiders highlights. I would go to the corner store every Monday and buy the USA Today, hoping that the write-up was in there with the picture, because then maybe I could get a picture of the Raiders. Like, that's just – and now we're in a spot where you're right. Like, if somebody has a bad practice in training camp, we know about it before anybody else. Like, it's wild how differently sports are consumed now. And to try and compare anything that happens today to what happened in the 90s or 80s or any of those other eras, athletes are under different pressure. They're under different scrutiny. That, like, can you imagine the difference in training camp now, knowing that if you had a bad practice, you're going to go on 15 different radio shows and be asked about it all of a sudden? That didn't exist then. Like,
no,
it's just crazy how much different it is to be an athlete in today's world.
And one final thing I wanted to end with, and it's something that you brought up earlier in one of your answers. And it is kind of funny, because I talk about this quite a bit on my podcast, is just, I hate hypotheticals. We hear it all the time when it comes to sports. Oh, yeah, you know, the 90s Bulls would have wiped the mat with the 2015 Golden State Warriors, and the Warriors say they would beat the Bulls. Michael Jordan still says, no. Who would guard me? Who would guard Scotty? Shaq still says, who's guarding me on the Golden State Warriors? Look, I hate getting into that, because it's never going to happen. You can't put them on the court in their primes and whatnot. But I will say this. Knowing that I watched the Lakers growing up in the 80s, again, you also can't compare it, because it is such a different game. You know, when you watch, I said, go turn on it. You know, they don't have ESPN Classic anymore. But when they used to play those games, go watch an 80s finals game and then compare it to the NBA game you're watching. You're telling me that those guys would, you know, yeah, the Lakers ran a little bit, but their offense consisted of, in the half court, let's just, you know, the center would run down and just sit on the block, because every team had a guy that was 6'10 or 7'1, and you throw it into Kareem and he skyhooks. Like, that was not boring, but there wasn't cuts, there wasn't back screens, there wasn't pick and rolls at the top of the key. It's like, okay, Shaq can say all he wants about who is going to guard me on the 2015 Warriors. Shaq, when they set a high screen 22 feet away from the basket, you're guarding Steph out there? Like, it's just, again, like, I say that you can't compare it, but I also think the players of today, better coached, better conditioned. The game is so much different. I think they actually wiped the mat, because I don't think Kareem Abdul-Jabbar never had to guard anybody outside the post. Now you're telling me Kareem would be able to guard a Steph Curry or an Ant 23 feet away from the basket on a high pick and roll? No, I don't think he would have, but that's just, again, personal opinion. But it's a different sport, and you can't compare the two.
I think I think where we have to align on part of this too is understanding that the greats will do whatever it takes to be great in any era. So I do think, for anyone that says, well, you know, LeBron couldn't handle the physicality. I mean, the guy bought a cryo chamber, for love of God. Like, I think if he was playing in a different era of NBA basketball, he would adjust his body accordingly and his training would be adjusted accordingly. I'd say the same for Michael. Like, for anyone that says, well, Michael couldn't handle this or that, he's Michael. I would think that if Michael Jordan were in his playing era today, that he would probably adjust, you know. And there's fatal flaws to every one of these arguments, because then you can turn around and say, well, look at how many games it took LeBron to even get to the point total that he has now compared to how many games Michael played. And I look at it and say, how incredible is it that LeBron is still playing at this age, right? So, like, I think you can make an argument for all of it. The one thing, though, that when it really comes down to it is, like, athleticism is athleticism. And to your point, I would challenge anybody, go back and watch the YouTube videos of 60s, 70s, 80s basketball. It's out there. You can watch anything. It blew my mind a few years ago. I was sitting on set on an ESPN show we were doing. I won't throw my co-host at the time under the bus, but we did a dumb rating just for fun on the show of the best Christmas movies. And I remember I listed honorable mention. I listed White Christmas and Holiday Inn, two classic movies that I've always loved. And she at the time was like, I've never seen either of those movies, no interest in it. And I said to her, I was like, everything's streaming now. So to just avoid classics is as obtuse to me as somebody that's old that avoids something new because they just don't want to consume new. Like, if you decide you hate new music before you've even listened to it, then you've really sold yourself short. If you are a kid today and you decide you hate old music before you've even listened to it, you sold yourself short. The problem on this argument is that I think what you have is a lot of people in the 80s and 90s who grew up watching basketball that aren't watching anymore. They just see the highlights and they hear everybody say, well, it's only shooting threes. It's a lame game now.
Yeah.
They're not watching it. And then you got people that are young that are watching the highlights that aren't going back and watching the MJ era, and they're making sweeping generalizations about them. To your point, I think if you go back and watch the 70s, 80s guys, you'll see that as a whole, from top to bottom, the athleticism now in the NBA is just at such a different level.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. To see somebody do what Jokic is capable of doing every single night is superhuman. And we take superhuman for granted. I'm not willing to do that. I think the athleticism today is at a different level. And I just don't know, without being sacrilegious to Kareem, could Kareem run the way guys run now? Like, could those guys actually run the way guys run now? I don't know, man. Like, I think the bottom of the roster NBA guy today would probably absolutely crush the bottom of the roster NBA guy from 20 years ago. And that has to be factored into the conversation about the league as a whole.
For sure. And yeah, Kareem had to guard nobody other than centers when he played. They didn't run pick and roll. He didn't have to guard Ant on a switch out on the perimeter, or someone as athletic as Ant. And like you said, the players just weren't as athletic back then. We could talk about this for centuries. I absolutely love it. It's a great debate. But Jason, thank you so much, man, for coming on. I definitely want to have you on again because there's so many topics that we could easily get into. Man, this is a great first appearance for you. Like I said, I want to do it again in the future. And, man, congratulations on all your success. I was glad I was able to find you. Glad Jason Stewart was able to put us in touch. And, man, good luck with everything. I'll be listening. Check him out, Fox Sports Radio on The Fellas, Saturday mornings. You can listen to that. Jason, thanks, man, for coming on. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you. Thanks for having me, man.
You got it. Thank you so much to Jason. Man, that's a hell of a story, his upbringing, his background. Being, you know, an Emmy award-winning fiddle player / violinist, that is crazy. And then just getting into sports radio, you can tell this guy grinds, this guy works very hard, and that's a really, really interesting take that he had about wanting to get out of the music industry. And he was just definitely sounds like a perfectionist. He knows his sports. Listen to him on Fox Sports Radio every Saturday morning with Anthony Gargano. The show is called The Fellas. He'll definitely be on again in the future. So thank you all for listening. Really appreciate it. Follow me on Apple Podcasts. Also rate and review, but you got to hit play. It's the only way it counts as a download. The Daily Roundup was posted an hour ago, so go check that out as well. Again, thank you all for listening. For Jason Fitz, I'm Reality Steve. And remember, sports will always be the greatest reality show in the world.